Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Happy Thanksgiving, Sydney.
Why, thank you, Justin.
Ho, ho, ho. He's just around the corner.
That's really it for Thanksgiving.
For me?
It's just a prelude to...
For me, it don't get better than seeing that jolly old fella on the sleigh at the end of the department store parade.
Okay.
That's when the season is here, folks.
Did you say department store parade? Like, we're not allowed to say Macy's?
Yeah. No, I was trying to heighten the absurdity of Christmas season being rung in by a department store chain. By saying department store.
Oh, okay.
I guess it didn't work.
I thought it was sort of like in Archie comics when they like have the names of celebrities, but they're off by like one letter.
If you have to ask yourself if I am or am not referencing Archie comics, you are usually going to be a lot safer going with the nay on that. But it, I mean, it's always possible.
It'll be like Bruce Springsteen.
Okay. You've kind of pivoted this into an opportunity to talk about Archie's, this is fine. I self like that.
I don't want to talk about Archie's. Uh-huh. I mean, I do, but
you
that's
do.
Not,
of course you
not
do.
For this show. I want to talk about herpes.
Okay. This is our Thanksgiving special, huh?
Yes. Herpes.
Okay.
Herpes simplex virus, HSV.
Okay. Why herpes?
Here's the thing. First of all, a lot of people want us to talk about herpes. Thank you to Kevin and Ransom and Christine and Bradley for suggesting something very easily searchable, HSV. I think a lot of other people have suggested cold sores, but that's a lot. That would have been a whole episode of thanking everybody. And also to search cold sores in the email, it just was harder. Anyway, so thank you everybody who's recommended this topic. I don't know why we haven't covered it. It's a very prevalent viral infection, and I don't know why we haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some people think it's kind of yucky to talk about.
There's a lot of stigma when it comes to herpes. I was thinking about that episode of Friends where Joey does the bus ads and the subway ads for getting tested for sexually transmitted infections, you know, as most do.
If you are ever wondering whether or not I remember a specific Friends episode, the answer to that is usually going to be nay.
Anyway, herpes viruses are incredibly common. HSV is so common that if you're an adult and you're listening to this podcast, you probably carry some type of HSV.
I don't think I do, but
you probably
I
do.
Probably do. Apparently,
we probably the majority of adults probably do. I say probably because we don't test people for it, and I'll get into why. But herpes is horribly stigmatized, and this Thanksgiving, I want to give you the information to empower you to go spend this joyous time with your friends and family destigmatizing herpes.
This is the Thanksgiving that you destigmatize herpes.
That's right.
You've waited long enough.
Herpes viruses are very common among animal species. It's interesting. Humans get two types.
Oh,
we're the lucky
us.
Most don't. Generally speaking, when I'm talking about herpes, you're probably thinking of one of two types of infections, because I'm sticking to HSV, herpes simplex viruses. I'm not going to get into like shingles and zoster. I'm really sticking to the two things you would think of, which are either cold sores, so oral herpes, which generally are caused by HSV1, and then genital herpes, which are generally caused by HSV2, although either can cause either. Both can do both.
Okay.
But generally, you see HSV-1 in the mouth and HSV-2 in the genitals, generally. Humans got HSV-1 before we evolved into humans.
Wow, really?
Like they infected one of our chimpanzee predecessors, evolutionary predecessors. We got HSV-2, though, after we were already humans, like after we had evolved into, at least to Homo erectus, at least.
Okay.
From like a primate predecessor.
Still extremely old.
But think about that for a second. Where is your mind going? There was a Homo erectus who got genital herpes from a Pliopleistocene hominin Paranthropus bozii, also known as Nutcracker Man.
You look so pleased with yourself right
now. I was. Nutcracker Man. It's because I guess he had these like big flat teeth that were good for cracking nuts.
Uh-huh.
But Nutcracker Man
But he's so much more multi-level than that, so he's got a lot to offer. Don't stop at the teeth, folks. That's as far as a lot of people see.
He gave a Homo erectus genital herpes.
Okay.
And that's how it got into humans.
Celebrate that. I celebrate their right to have whatever kind of loving relationship they want to. Unlike my wife, who's ready to cast scorn.
I'm not, because it is quite possible that Homo erectus just ate Nutcracker Man, and that's how we got herpes from him.
I'm sorry, Nutcracker Man, for all the disparaging things that we've said and for eating you. Sorry, my great-grandfather ate Nutcracker Man.
I'd say it goes a little further back. Many people are infected with HSV, as I've said, and for the most part, it causes what really, like, from a purely medical perspective, and this is not getting into the stigma or the psychological effects of getting a sexually transmitted infection, just like purely medically speaking, the actual damage it does to the human body it's not that severe.
Really?
You get a cold sore, it goes away. Maybe another one comes back. You get some sores on your genitals, then they go away. So like, as far as like physical damage to the human body, it's a fairly benign infection, right?
I'll have to take your word for it, yes.
A lot of people carry it around and don't know they have it. So in that way, it's very benign. You might be carrying herpes and have no clue. So for you, as a physical effect on your body, it's not the worst case scenario, right?
Right.
Now, it can do some things. I say this to differentiate it from some of the more serious things that this virus can do. It can cause things like encephalitis, like an inflammation of the brain, which is obviously a much bigger problem. It can cause infections in newborns, which can be very serious. It can cause some infections in your eyes. You can get some other things on other parts of your body. There's one that I always like to talk about, herpes gladiatorum.
Gladiatorum. Have we talked about that before? It seems like we have.
Maybe. It's named for wrestlers.
Oh.
Gladiatorum.
Oh, okay. Got it.
It's named for wrestlers. Because it's also called wrestler's herpes or mat herpes. Or scrum pox, which is a horrible name.
That's the worst word you've ever said.
But you can get it other places on your trunk from like contact with wrestlers or, you know.
Any wrestlers?
Well, no, like not any, but like wrestlers who have herpes.
Pretty much any wrestler that you wrestle
not
with.
Not any wrestlers. There's also one called herpetic whitlow, which is on the fingers, just in case you're curious. Like I said, the most common manifestations are the sores in your mouth or the sores on your genitals. And as far as the presentation, there's a huge variety. Some people carry it around and don't really know they have it because they just either their outbreak, the first one was so minimal, they didn't even notice, or they got it, they didn't really know what it was, went away, never had another one. Whereas other people might have multiple, you know, instances of sores throughout their life. It just depends. It varies from person to person. It is much more severe if you are in some way immunocompromised.
Mm.
If your immune system cannot respond, as most do to an infection, you could get a much more severe infection. It is an ancient disease. The word herpes comes from the Greek to creep, because the sores tend to creep. And when we go back to like Hippocrates writing about herpes, it's important to note that he was talking about probably what we know as HSV. But he was also probably talking about shingles, zoster. He was also probably talking about chickenpox. He was also probably talking about a variety of other skin conditions, viral or non-viral, that just kind of look similar.
Mm.
So it's hard to differentiate if we look at ancient texts. Like everybody always likes to talk about Pliny the Elder had some wild ideas about shingles and zoster and about what would happen if the infection wrapped around your whole body and you would die and it would be terrible. And anyway, he was probably talking about a different thing. So it all looked the same. They used the same word herpes because it was a creeping skin infection, but they weren't necessarily always discussing HSV.
Okay.
Roman Emperor Tiberius tried to stop the spread of herpes. He at least identified that somehow it was something that was communicable. And specifically, he was probably focused on cold sores. Because those are easily visible, right?
Yeah.
That was right. Probably the reason they
Hot
were the most.
Topic.
Yeah. I mean, you could look at a potential kissing partner and see cold sores.
Whenever I'm on a first date, I always like to address them as a potential kissing partner.
I'm just saying, you have a potential kissing partner.
No, it's a sexy way of saying it. I'm down.
So he banned public kissing.
Oh, no.
To try to stop the spread.
I'm going to move out of this stupid country.
There weren't a lot of, I mean, there were a lot of probably herbal type cures and things like that. I mean, it's important to remember cold sores then as now go away. Mm-hmm. They run their course, right? Mm-hmm. Like you get a cold sore, it hurts and it goes away and it might come back later, but it goes away on its own. So people probably put stuff on it in the meantime.
Are they usually triggered by trauma?
They can be stress or trauma or illness or things like that. Bring them out.
I feel like anytime I bite my lip, I just know I'm going to get one there. Mm-hmm. It always turns into one. It's the worst.
And it is important to know there's the herpes virus induced ulcers that are, you know, that we're talking about. There's also aphthous ulcers in the mouth, which aren't necessarily the same thing, but can result just ulcers that can result from trauma, like biting the inside of your lip or your
Maybe
tongue.
It's just those, though, because I've never got one on the outside of my mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. So,
huh.
But also, like, I always know if I eat some really acidic things, drink some acidic things, that'll happen, or when I'm sick. But these same things can bring out herpes. They used to consider treating them with hot irons to cauterize the sores.
Oh, that's brutal.
Not a popular treatment, though, because, you know, they just go away and that would hurt.
Yeah, I'm good.
And they already hurt and now that would hurt more. A lot of people wrote about herpes. Everybody always likes to mention that Shakespeare wrote about herpes.
Oh, what he's have?
In Romeo and Juliet, when he talks about, or a lady's lips who straight on kisses dream, which off the angry mab with blisters plague, because their breaths with sweetmeats tainted are.
That's nice. Sid, you did a really good job of respecting the iams. And the pentameter in that
Thank
read.
You. Thank you.
Great job.
Anyway,
the verse.
I put that in there purely because everybody who likes to talk about the history of herpes seems to like to mention that Shakespeare wrote about it. So I don't know if that makes it cooler, trendier. It's like, listen, Hipper. I am on trend. Shakespeare wrote about this. We figured out in the late 1800s and the early 1900s that herpes sores were distinct from all these other creeping infections.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were caused by a virus and that it was infectious and eventually that there were two separate types. And I don't want to get into that too much because here's the truth. It wasn't that big a deal for a long time.
We are dying for so many reasons.
It wasn't that big a deal. And so certainly like one of the herbal cures I saw, like tansy was a common thing to put on it. But no, I mean, like a lot of people weren't going for the hot irons because who cares? Everybody has them. They're super common. It goes away. We can live with it. That was really the idea. In the realm, I was trying to find weird herpes cures, and there really aren't a lot that are easy to research because they were so often overlapped with other skin infections. Mm-hmm. The most common one I found was attributed to Dr. Oz. So I found the clip from Dr. Oz to look for a weird...
Welcome back to the show, Draws, by the way. What a treat. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for joining us. I wouldn't have believed this if I hadn't seen the clip myself. He was talking with two guests on the show, two women who have herpes, and he had them both put on headbands that had like different triggers of herpes. So like getting back to like one said stress, one said illness, and they formed a herpes train.
Uh-huh.
And they made it like a choo-choo train around the stage.
Folks, he's got an hour to fill every day. You deal with that pressure and let me know how you handle it.
Anyway, some stuff that he recommends, which is probably in line with a lot of the stuff throughout history that it's been recommended, is like steep a tea bag in hot water. Steep a tea bag in hot water and then put it on there and it'll dry it out. People always love to dry things out. I found that. That's always an alternative medicine thing. It'll dry it out. Okay. Sure. Thanks. That doesn't, whatever. They say that the tannins will do that. Lemon balm, eat foods rich in lysine, low in arginine, yogurt.
Okay.
I looked into
eat yogurt's pretty good advice for pretty much all
sure.
the time.
Sure. I mean, eat yogurt. That's great. But I looked into some of these things, by the way. And as far as I can tell, there was a study done once that suggested that a whole lot of lysine in your body can help like suppress the virus somewhat. So
what foods are rich in lysine?
Largely like meat and then things like seeds or nuts. And there was like some evidence that if you could keep your lysine level in your body at a certain level, that perhaps in some people it might suppress the virus once you've already gotten it somewhat, but the evidence wasn't strong. And another study said it really doesn't work unless you also limit your arginine. And then it said, well, never mind. It doesn't work at all. So I don't know. Dr. Oz made a train to describe it.
Thanks, Dr. Oz.
You can watch that
if
you feel so inclined. For centuries, though, herpes was something we didn't really get too troubled over. Even as we started to really care about sexually transmitted infections, which you can really trace back to like the world wars, World War One, a lot of soldiers went away and then came back with what were called at the time social diseases.
Oh, how polite.
Social diseases. And that kind of led to this public panic, like this idea that was going to happen anytime you had sex. And at the time, let's be honest, not with your monogamous married partner was kind of the implication. And so there were all these sexually transmitted infection awareness campaigns. But even then, they weren't talking about herpes. The itch down there was not that big a deal. It was really just syphilis, gonorrhea. Those were the things. Chancroid. Those were the things people were really concerned about. It didn't become a problem until the 70s.
What happened in the 70s?
I'm going to tell you, Justin. But first, let's head to the billing department.
I think I'd see him coming. Let's go.
The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth.
So, Sid, to hear you tell it, everybody was crazy about herpes. They loved the stuff. And then around the 70s, that started to take a turn.
Well, I didn't say everybody was crazy about it. It just wasn't. It was kind of one of those things, like a lot of people got cold sores and a lot of people were probably getting, you know, sores on their genitals. And they just weren't. I mean, whatever. They weren't talking
about it.
They
weren't making a federal case out of it.
Right. People weren't seeking a lot of treatment for it is the truth. In the 70s, though, a few different things happened that changed that. First, the first big deal drug to treat herpes was released. The first one that didn't have a lot of horrible side effects and was targeted at herpes, at HSV. It was released by Burroughs Wellcome Company, which I think is now GlaxoSmithKline, I believe. But Zovirax or Acyclovir, as you probably have heard it now.
Zovirax. I'm here to cure your herpes. Earth herpes.
I don't think the commercial was like that, but I wish it was.
It'd be good.
It would have been a good commercial. But it was originally like the idea, because we had antibiotics, right? Like this is like by this time in history, we already have penicillin and all of the antibiotics that came thereafter. Well, quite a few of them by this point. And we knew we could treat and cure bacterial infections. The next big landmark was, can we treat and cure viral infections the way we do bacterial? Viruses are harder, which is why, as you know, we don't have a lot of antivirals, mm-hmm. right? I mean, think about it. When you come in and we say you got a virus, we don't give you anything for it because we don't have anything that'll help with that. And most of the time they're self-limited and it's not a big deal anyway. Well, there are, as I mentioned, life-threatening manifestations of the herpes virus in certain patients under certain conditions. And so we did need drugs to treat that. But the idea as they introduced acyclovir among their marketing team was that that's not enough, because those life-threatening infections are not very common. Mm-hmm. And while that certainly is a good use for our drug, we want to sell it to more people. We've put in all this time and effort and research and development to make this drug, and we want to make a ton of money off of it. But most people just don't care enough about herpes to bother to treat it, and certainly not to pay for a brand new antiviral medication, right? Mm-hmm. And this is supported by the fact that as late as 1975, there was a study done, psychological morbidity in a clinic for sexually transmitted disease. So this is, I kind of mentioned earlier that from like a purely physical, like cellular destruction standpoint, most herpes, it's not that big a deal. But from a psychological standpoint, now we would say it's a huge deal for a lot of patients. Well, as of 1975, when they did a study on the specific psychological effects of getting an STI, they don't even mention herpes.
So it's like nobody
cared. Because nobody cared. They didn't. It wasn't even included in the study, because the idea that people would be suffering a psychological, you know, some sort of illness from a herpes infection was just unheard of. Nobody would care. Why would we? So they needed a strategy. How do we get people to care about herpes?
Mm.
So they launched a disease awareness campaign.
No. I should have seen this coming.
They were emphasizing the importance of treating genital herpes specifically. So they didn't focus on cold sores because, I mean, for one, you can see that a lot of people have them. So it was hard to stigmatize cold sores.
Right.
Even if a lot of people have genital herpes, you're not seeing that on the street on a regular basis.
It's hard
basis.
To make that a secret shame.
Yes.
Right.
So they started focusing on the idea. First of all, they started using terminology like incurable. This is incurable. You're going to get herpes having sex, and it's never going to be cured.
You'll carry around your entire life.
And that was a radical idea to introduce into the public at the time, because people really didn't feel that way about herpes. And so all of a sudden they painted genital herpes as this huge deal that you had to manage, because not only were you going to have it forever, you're going to give it to someday your poor blushing bride. You're going to give her herpes, and how bad will you feel? And so they started to create this idea that herpes was something that had to be treated, had to be managed. You had to go see a doctor for instantly, and you had to deal with this disease burden the rest of your life. So they started organizing special teaching for doctors. I don't know if there was food. I don't know if there were golfing outings. I don't know if there were free box seats to sporting events, but my experience in the medical community leads me to believe there probably was.
Yeah.
There were at the very least nice cups and pens, right? So they started organizing all these teaching sessions for doctors. They organized support groups. Why would there have been a support group?
For nobody people was, with herpes?
Yes. Support groups for people with herpes so that they could get to her. And they started using words like sufferers and victims. Around this same time, and this wasn't the doing of the pharmaceutical company, this was just the atmosphere in the U.S. in general, conservatives began to use HSV as an example of the negative consequences of the sexual revolution. So, Listen, I know all you hippies think you're having such a good time with your free love and your sex, but guess what? Now y'all got herpes, and it's terrible. So in July of 1980, Time Magazine published a cover article titled Herpes, the New Sexual Leprosy. And they talked about things like there was one case where a man contracted herpes after he, quote, succumbed to the temptation of a local lady while he was abroad Asia. They ran another cover story in 1982 calling herpes the New Scarlet Letter. And they talked about herpes as altering sexual rights in America and changing courtship patterns. And it is a numbing blow to the one night stand. This is the way they talked
just
about
completely.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I would say, I am not a journalist. I would say this is biased journalism.
Yeah. I mean, it obviously is. Well, it's not biased journalism. I think that there's a real vulnerability. I used to cover health from time to time because we didn't have like a health reporter at one of the newspapers I worked at. And there's real vulnerability in the press when you have a press that, and this is why it's so important to support your local press. When you don't have people who are well educated about this sort of thing, then people will buy whatever line you feed them. If you're a doctor and you come to a reporter and say, hey, this is a health thing that I know about and you don't, pretty, you know, obviously you should be vetting that stuff, but you know, it's easy to get roped in by something like that.
I see that stuff all the time. I see their reports where doctors are being quoted, and I know because I believe in science and evidence-based medicine that what they're saying is totally off the charts from what the majority of medical professionals believe. But they're a doctor, so they're getting quoted. But this article painted herpes as the scourge of basically people that you didn't want to be, people who cheated on their partners, people who were swingers.
Swingers.
That it was something that you could use to scare your husbands into faithfulness. So women lecture your husbands about herpes.
So they don't bring home herpes to you.
And like a scare tactic. And ladies, if you get herpes, your husbands will leave you. Your first outbreak, your husbands are going to leave you. So don't have sex. Mm. So they basically were using this as a way to say, listen, all that sex was fun and stuff, but we're done. It's the 80s. No more sex.
Listen, there are other very good reasons why we should be telling you this, and we're going to find out about them here in like a few years. This is correct information we're giving you, not for the reasons we're telling you.
Listen,
about
I don't think no more sex is correct information. I think use proper protection is correct information.
Okay, fair. Yes, fine.
Are you? I didn't know you were an abstinence only fan.
I'm not an abstinence only fan. I'm just saying that like there are repercussions of like unprotected sex that were not being dealt with at this time period. Okay, herpes is not the right reason to deal with it, but I'm not saying it was like the worst advice to like use protection.
The problem is that it's wrapped into this was not doctors and medical professionals advocating for safe sex so that you could, you know, reduce the spread of sexually transmitted infections and prevent an unwanted pregnancy and all that. It was people who believed sex was bad, morally bad,
I get it.
Lecturing America on their bad sex that they're having. That I think that's my problem. It's not a moral thing. It's a medical thing. Either way, in 1983, there was a made-for-TV movie called Intimate Agony about herpes. Intimate Agony. There were articles published in Reader's Digest, not just Time and U.S. News, and they talked about this awful herpes wave that was sweeping the country, and it was the repercussions of our promiscuity. We were reaping the benefits of our sexual harvest with herpes. And the result of all this, which, by the way, there's a name for this, disease mongering.
Oh,
that's what this is called. And it is largely believed that the reason we have a stigma against herpes today is because of the disease mongering that you can somewhat lay at the foot of the pharmaceutical companies. They had to find a market for their drug, but also, I mean, prominent figures in the country at large.
Suspects.
Yeah. To make this stigma attached to the diagnosis. And then as a result, patients began to seek treatment. As I mentioned, and I've been very careful to differentiate, while the physical effects of herpes for most patients are fairly benign, like a lot of people are carriers and don't even know they have it, so their physical effects are zero. The psychological effects of getting this diagnosis now can be a lot more devastating. There was a study in the New England Journal that said the psychological effects are far more severe than the physical consequences for many patients, and shock, anger, guilt, low self-esteem, fear of transmitting the infection, impaired sexual function can follow. You can lead to social withdrawal and isolation, and especially in young people, because they're given this diagnosis and then told that it is incurable. So you have this the rest of your life, and you have to tell every sexual partner, and they're not going to like you because you have herpes now. Which I should be clear, you should always disclose your sexual history to a potential partner before engaging in sexual intercourse or any other sexual behavior, but not so that they'll know what a dirty person you are.
Right.
So that you can both enter into an honest, open sexual relationship. By 2007, herpes was ranked the second most stigmatized STI after HIV. It isn't part, by the way, this is a common question. Why isn't it part of a standard screen for sexually transmitted infections? Because a lot of people believe, advocates believe that if we started screening everybody for herpes when we screen them for things like gonorrhea or chlamydia or syphilis or HIV or hepatitis, that we could reduce the stigma, because then we would see that it's estimated maybe as many as 90% of adults have HSV.
Mm-hmm. And it's weird if you don't have it.
Right. So if we knew that everybody had it, then there wouldn't be a stigma. And so problem solved. There's several. One is very practical. It's expensive. Mm-hmm. It's an expensive test to run. And so to make it part of a routine screen for sexually transmitted infections would make those screens incredibly expensive. And the nice thing is there are a lot of places you can go and get those screens for free. And I don't, you know, I think most of us would agree. We don't want that to stop. We want you to be able to get screened for free.
Yeah.
So that's one problem, is the test is so expensive. Another problem is that herpes, as I mentioned, from a lot of, from a lot of doctors' perspective, is not the biggest deal in the world. And so it's hard to justify adding this incredibly expensive screen and then giving people this information that might be incredibly psychologically upsetting to them. Mm-hmm. They might never have another sore. You might tell somebody you have the herpes virus and they never, the rest of their life, have any physical manifestation about it. So there's that question. Now, of course, they can transmit it, possibly. Not everybody. And I say not everybody because sometimes it's just hard to detect the herpes virus. So the test may be wrong. So we might tell you you don't have it and we're wrong. Mm-hmm. And again, it's kind of a moot point. Why test for it when we can just assume, are you an adult? Yeah, you probably have it. Don't worry about it.
Pass the cranberry.
So even if you have a positive result, what will we do about it?
Nothing.
For a lot of people, we wouldn't. Now, we do have ways to treat herpes, as I mentioned. There's either suppressive therapy, which is you take medicine every single day to try to prevent ever getting any sores. Or you can take it just when, sores show up. So if you get a cold sore, if you get some genital lesions, you can take some medication and it'll help them go away faster and reduce the pain and everything. But the stigma is as bad as ever, maybe even getting worse, some studies have shown over time.
So this Thanksgiving, what do we need people to do?
We need you to reduce the stigma.
Go to your family.
Tell them they all probably have herpes.
Announce it. I have an announcement to make. Deborah and I are very much in love. And also everyone in this room has herpes. And that's fine. And it's fine with me. I have it too. It's fine.
Well, I think that if we're going to, we've talked a lot about both sides. I think this has been interesting, Justin, because you have introduced a lot of the other side of the sexual revolution to this conversation. And I think that it's important that it's from both sides. If we're going to take good care of ourselves and each other, we have to be open and honest. And the best way to encourage us to be open and honest is to destigmatize the things we're being open and honest about, so that there's no shame. It's just an infection. It's not a judgment on your moral character. Now, and that is not my way of saying, so like, why do you care so much? What's the big deal? Obviously you care because we do live in a society that shames people for getting sexually transmitted infections, and that's wrong and it should stop, but it doesn't take away the fact that this is a big deal for people who are struggling with like that knowledge. But it shouldn't be.
Make sure when you tweet this episode, make sure you include, just include, hi, my name is whatever. I probably have herpes and you should check out the new episode of Sawbones. And just link to it.
So. Most adults have herpes.
My name is Justin McElroy and I probably have herpes, statistically speaking.
Statistically, I think HSV-1 is more common than HSV-2.
I made a proclamation. And
my name is Sydney McElroy, and I probably have herpes, statistically speaking.
Yeah. So that's good. There's a lot of couching of it, but I celebrate that. Folks, we hope you have a great Thanksgiving holiday armed with this mission to destigmatize herpes. We have certainly enjoyed. I want to say that we're thankful for you.
Yes.
We're also thankful for everybody who has picked up our book. It's Sawbones. The Sawbones Book is what it's called. And you can find that at fine retailers everywhere. You know, Christmas is just around the corner, folks, and it makes just a darn great gift, this book of ours. And you know, it's not just a physical book. It's also
audiobook.
Thank you, Sinster. And that is available right now for you to go grab on Audible, former sponsor of ours, or anywhere
the podcast, probably just
Audible.
The podcast has become a book, has become an audiobook.
Audible.
The snake has eaten itself.
Yes.
Please check our book. And don't eat romaine lettuce.
Don't eat romaine lettuce, apparently.
Yeah. I feel like I should say that since I'm a physician.
Yeah, don't eat romaine lettuce.
The CDC has warned you. Do not eat any romaine lettuce. So if anybody tries to serve you that.
And this is the second time, right?
Yes.
So can we all agree that probably wraps it up for romaine lettuce. Nobody is so stoked about Roma that they're like.
I love romaine lettuce.
Okay, there's one person that's stoked about romaine lettuce. Folks,
I am so bummed, but don't eat it.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with you next week. Maybe a little bit delayed because we're going to be on the road, but we'll figure it out. We'll figure something out.
Yeah.
But until that time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
As always, don't drill a hole in your head.
All right. Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.